Dean Duane sat outside the door of room 207, Linda Gordon's room. He had replaced Riker, who'd gone off shift at midnight. Wes Crawley guarded the door to the back stairs at the far end of the corridor in the rear of the building. The long corridor was straight, allowing the two men to keep each other in view. Dean Duane was square-built, with a thick, straight torso. He was hatless and wore a lightweight gray suit, white shirt, and black tie. Crawley was similarly attired. Davenport liked his bodyguards to dress like businessmen so they'd be properly attired for his world of banks and boardrooms. A little after three, the rear door opened and a man stepped inside. Wes Crawley rose, facing him. Duane turned his head, looking down the hall to see what it was all about. He stirred with interest. Any interruption to the monotony of guard duty was a welcome diversion. The newcomer held a serving tray in both hands. On it was a coffee pot and some cups and saucers. Duane's mouth watered. He hungered for the taste of some strong, black, fresh brew. The waiter, or kitchen help, for so the newcomer most obviously seemed to be, grasped the coffee pot by the handle in one hand and balanced the serving tray on the upraised palm of his other hand. He poured a cup of coffee. Crawley took the cup and saucer and sat down. He held the coffee cup in one hand, while his other held the saucer on top of one of his thighs. He nodded to Duane, grinning. Crawley sat drinking coffee while the waiter came up the hall to Dean Duane. The waiter was a regular beanpole, thought Duane. He was balding, with a thin, horseshoe-shaped fringe of brown hair framing a shiny, gleaming scalp. Beneath a white bib apron, he wore a faded red flannel shirt and striped gray trousers tucked into knee-high boot tops. Shirt sleeves were rolled up to the elbows. As he approached, Duane took note of the gleaming silver-plated coffee pot, another cup and saucer, and some white folded linen napkins on the tray. Dean Duane rose, the full, rich aroma of coffee tingling in his nostrils.
Compliments of the hotel, sir. The manager thought you might like some coffee.
I sure would.
The waiter repeated the process of pouring coffee, filling the cup. Duane took the cup in hand. It was a big, oversized mug, a man-sized cup of coffee.
That's good. Thanks.
You're welcome, sir.
Duane sat down, steaming cup of coffee in one hand, saucer in the other. The waiter hovered around, standing so that he blocked Duane's view of Crawley.
Something you want?
Perhaps you'd care for a napkin, sir? Don't want to risk staining your clothes.
Good idea.
The waiter's bony hand reached under a folded napkin on the tray, coming out with a derringer. He pointed it at Duane's forehead. His body was turned so Crawley, at the other end of the hall, could see nothing amiss. The derringer was a pearl-handled, double-barreled, over-under job bearing two shots with two triggers.
Blink and you're dead.
He stepped back, turning his head so he could see Crawley and Duane at the same time. His body screened the derringer from Crawley's view. He nodded several times. Crawley thought he was nodding at him and raised his cup in a friendly salute. Crawley was unaware that the rear door was open a crack. Somebody stood behind the door looking through the crack, watching for the go-ahead signal, which had now been given. The door silently opened and a man came out, a short, slight man holding a big knife. He carefully snuck up behind Crawley and slashed the knife across his throat. The cup and saucer fell from Crawley's hands, dropping to the carpeted floor. The knife man stabbed the blade into Crawley's heart. It brought instant death. Crawley slumped.
Good Lord.
Shut up. Do as you're told and you'll get out of this alive. Otherwise, you'll get what your friend got.
A third man entered via the rear door. Sid Felder, a bad man and longtime Angus Jones associate. A burly man, he had wavy black hair with a widow's peak, thick black eyebrows, and a mustache. He wore a six-gun and a black leather holster. The knife wielder was Tom Bardo, a Missouri outlaw. He was slight, sharp-featured, with a pointed nose and chin. He had long, stringy hair and a wispy mustache and chin whiskers. He wore a gun, but the blade was his specialty. Slim Giles motioned with the derringer.
Either barrel could blow your brains out, so don't try anything funny. Sit the cup and saucer down on the floor. Good, stand up.
Dwayne rose shakily, his complexion leaden under a sheen of cold sweat. Slim set the tray down on the flat seat bottom, keeping Dwayne covered with the derringer. He stepped in, pressing the barrels to the side of Dwayne's head while reaching under the guard's coat to pull the gun from his holster. Stepping back, he leveled both guns on the guard.
Turn around and face the wall.
Don't kill me, please.
Shut the hell up.
Dwayne stood facing the wall to the left of the door to room 207. Slim pocketed the derringer, transferring Dwayne's short, stubby, solid-built big bore revolver to his right hand, gun butt first. Dwayne's eyes rolled up in his head, the whites showing. He started to fold up. Slim's free hand collared him at the back of the neck. He eased Dwayne down to the floor in a heap. Slim looked around warily. All was clear, with nobody sticking their head outside their room door to investigate. Sid Felder and Tom Bardo came down the hall, guns in hand. Felder reached for the door handle of room 207, his gun leveled hip high. The door was unlocked, handle turning under his hand. He eased the door open. Within, the anteroom was empty, a table lamp burning. The bedroom door was closed. Felder stepped back, making eye contact with Bardo.
Take care of the girl and anybody with her. Try not to make any noise, but shoot if you must. We'll blast our way out of here if we have to.
Bardo nodded, pale eyes shining. He padded into the anteroom. Felder stood outside the room door, looking in, watching him. Slim Giles stood with gun drawn, serving as lookout.
Go with Bardo.
What for? He knows what to do. He doesn't need help from me.
He likes to use that knife too much. Make sure he finishes the gal off fast with no nonsense. I'll keep watch.
Slim nodded and entered the anteroom. Bardo had the bedroom door open a hand's breadth and was looking in as Slim's shadow fell on him. Bardo looked over his shoulder, face alive with unholy delight.
Room's dark. The gal's alone in bed, sleeping.
He holstered his gun and drew his knife, its mirror-bright surfaces gleaming with reflected light.
Sid says finish her off fast.
Sure.
Bardo eased the door partly open and slid sideways through the opening into the dark bedroom. The sole source of light was lamplight from the anteroom. Bardo moved deeper into the room, out of Slim's sight. Slim waited for Bardo to emerge, his pounding heartbeats measuring out the time. It seemed like a long time, but Slim reckoned that was just nerves. More time passed while Slim fidgeted. Slim looked back at the main door to see Sid's head peeking into the antechamber.
Hurry up. Bardo's still in there.
What's the stall?
Slim shrugged, holding his palms up in an I-don't-know gesture.
Get him.
I don't want to get him riled. He's real mean with a knife in his hand.
What do you think I sent you in there for? To wring your hands? Get moving and haul his ass out of there.
Okay.
Slim quietly walked up to the doorway into the bedroom and stopped. It was mighty quiet in the bedroom. He opened the door wider, stepping inside.
Bardo!
Light shone through the doorway, laying a yellow oblong on the floor. The rest of the room was very dark. Slim's eyes had trouble adjusting to the dimness. An angle of light fell on a brass bedpost at the foot of the bed. He moved toward it. Before he knew what happened, he was on the floor and weaponless. He had fallen amidst a tangle of limbs, and not all the limbs were his own. He quickly rose to hands and knees and felt around for his gun, touching a body. He groped it, feeling around its contours with fear and frenzy fast rising in him. This was not the flesh of a young female. This was the body, the corpse of a male.
Bardo!
Slim's hands were sticky with wetness.
Oh, crap!
He jumped to his feet and started for the doorway, but before he could reach it, something hit him in his back. Slim staggered forward as if struggling against hip-deep mud, seemingly expending an awesome effort to advance each single step. Even as Felder watched open-mouthed, the light went out of Slim's bulging eyes, orbs glazing over in death. A war hatchet lay buried deep in his back between the shoulder blades.
Shit! Oh, screw the money. I'm getting out of here.
Felder spun toward the rear of the building, ready to race to the end of the corridor, down the back stairs and away, only to come face to face with Matt Bodine. Matt was in the corridor, coming on with drawn gun, barring the way to the back stairs and escape. Felder swung his gun up to fire. Felder didn't even have a chance to pull the trigger. A bullet tagged him high on the right side of his chest, below the collarbone, and he fell to the floor. Matt stood in the middle of the hallway, gun leveled at the hip, gun smoke hazing his form. Felder started crawling across the floor, clawing for his gun with his left hand. Matt shot him in the hand, blowing off some fingers. Felder lay on his side in the fetal position. He hugged his maimed hand to him, his right arm limp, unresponsive, and useless. Matt approached, bending at the knees to scoop up Felder's gun. He circled past him, looking into room 207. Sam Two Wolves was in the anteroom, hunkered down beside Slim. His gun was in his holster, unfired. He'd done for Bardo and Slim with his tomahawk. He and Matt had laid a trap for Felder and his sidemen. Linda Gordon was safe in another room. She'd been moved earlier to room 204, which had a connecting door with Davenport's suite. Remy Marcand and Riker were in there guarding her, with Mrs. Sanderson present as chaperone. Social proprieties must be observed, no matter what kill-happy characters might be on the prowl. Matt and Sam had come up with the scheme earlier still, after meeting with Ringo and Curly Bill at the Big Sky Saloon.
What are you trying to do, save on bullets?
Just trying to be quiet. I didn't want to wake anybody up.
Well, that didn't work out so well.
Sam joined Matt in the hallway. Hotel guests had stayed safely behind locked room doors during the gunplay, but they were all coming out to gaze and gawk now. Remy Marcand was there, gun at his side. Riker stood in the doorway of room 204, wanting to see what happened, but unwilling to leave Linda Gordon's room unguarded. Colonel Davenport was there in his nightshirt, a pair of hastily thrown-on trousers underneath, his feet shod in bedroom slippers. He was bright-eyed and alert, seemingly not a bit sleepy. Arnhold Stebbins was there, too, his sole concession to the informality of the late hour being that his jacket was off and the knot of his tie loosened. Matt and Sam walked over to Sid Felder.
Well, well. Sid Felder. So, you managed to take him alive.
The hard part was not finishing him off. Polecats like Sid were made for Boot Hill. You know us, Sid, Sam and me.
Yeah, I know you. You bastards.
Actually, both our mothers were married, which I'm sure is more than you can say.
I'll tell you something about your mothers.
Sid, you better be careful. You don't want your tongue cut out, do you?
Don't do that. He's got to talk.
Oh, thanks for reminding me, Sam. Oh, well, I'm sure there's other parts we can cut off if it's needful.
Misguided folks who think being an outlaw is some big, bold, romantic thing should see you now, Sid. Look at you. You're a mess.
Oh, screw you.
Where's Black Angus, Sid?
Who?
Jones left Sid here to die while he went to the slave auction in Pago.
Oh, never heard of it.
Better take him where nobody can interfere. You know how tender-hearted some folks can be, even with a sidewinder like Sid.
Room 207 should fit the bill. There's already two bodies in there.
Ah, good idea.
Sam bent over, taking hold of one of Felder's feet while Matt grasped the other.
I don't know nothing. Help me, someone.
Together, they dragged him into the antechamber of room 207. They let him go and straightened up. Felder lay on the floor. Sam went down on one knee beside Felder, gripping an ear between thumb and forefinger and twisting it to get Felder's attention. He let go shortly after.
Listen up, Sid. You know us and you know we don't play. I'm gonna ask you one more time. Where's Black Angus Jones?
In hell, with your mother.
Matt rocked him with a backhanded slap that made Felder see stars. Blood trickled from smashed lips.
You would have it the hard way, Sid. Okay, Sam. Scalp him.
I know just the thing.
Sam stood and went into the bedroom.
You're bluffing.
You think so?
Sam returned holding Bardo's knife.
This should do the trick.
You can't scare me.
I don't want to scare you, Sid. I want to scalp you.
Sam hunkered down beside Felder on the side opposite from Matt.
Nice hair, Sid. Good and thick. Your scalp would look good hanging on the reins of my pony.
You go to hell.
Better hold him down, Matt. This is going to hurt, and I don't want him thrashing around. It might make the scalp come off uneven.
Makes sense.
Matt planted a knee on Felder's left shoulder and chest, pinning his upper body to the floor. Sam crouched over him, knife in hand.
I'll talk. I'll say anything you want. Only don't scalp me, please. Please don't scalp me.
Sam and Matt exchanged glances.
You're not funny, Sid. You'll tell us what we want to know.
Oh, yes. Yes, oh, Lord, yes. Only please don't scalp me, please.
Just like I thought. A yellow belly.
Oh, please don't scalp me.
Black Angus Jones and his gang were taking the 7 young female captives from the Bear Paw wagon train to Pago in Sonora, Mexico. With them were 5 other girls they'd abducted along the way. The females were being transported by wagon. Wagons looted from the sacking of the Bear Paw caravan. The gang moved out from Yellowsnake Canyon the morning of the raid, heading south. Angus Jones was unhappy, to put it mildly, with Linda Gordon's escape from Dorado and Quirk Fane. He sent Felder, Slim, and Bardo to Tombstone to silence her. Meanwhile, he and the gang kept pushing south to Mexico. Felder and the others were supposed to meet Jones in the town of Fronteras, across the border in Mexico. Jones had some business to take care of there. He was not staying overnight, but would only be in Fronteras for a few hours before resuming the trek. If Felder and his sidemen missed Jones in Fronteras, they would catch up with him in Pago. Pago was about 60 miles south of the border, located in the Sierra Espinoso del Diablo, the mountain range known as the Devil's Spine. The isolated mountain town was a safe zone for outlaws, Mexican or American, as long as they were connected to the slave trade. Don Carlos de la Vega was a power in that part of Sonora. Pago and its surrounding area was his own. A private army of gunmen enforced his will and law. He was in cahoots with Captain Bravo, commanding officer of a body of troops garrisoned in Pago. Bravo's men patrolled the outlying roads and trails, providing some protection against Victorio and his outlaws, who had taken refuge in Sonora's Sierra Madre Mountains, of which the Espinazo was a small part. This much and more Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves learned from Sid Felder. Wheels were turning in Tombstone. Things were happening despite the late night hour. Hastily called meetings and conferences were held at the Hotel Earl, where Colonel Davenport held court. Runners were sent around town to knock on doors and wake men up, citizens whose services were needed pronto. Word raced along the grapevine that something big was in the offing. The result was that a group of bold, hard gunmen gathered at the OK Corral at first light. Night was on the wane, the overarching vault of sky fading from blackness to a rich purple and royal blue color. The moon hung low in the west, the sun had still not shone in the east. Lanterns hung on posts were pale yellow blurs floating amidst a sea of blue shadows. Smeared along the eastern horizon was a patch of ghostly brightness that was the forerunner of sunrise. That first light called by whites the false dawn, and by Indians the wolf's tail. Present at the scene were those brothers of the wolf, Matt and Sam. It was a sleepless night for the wolf brethren. Colonel Davenport had picked them to head an emergency rescue mission into Mexico to free the captive girls. Luckily, this was Tombstone, where there was no shortage of tough men who knew how to handle a gun. When the call went out for volunteers, the problem lay not in finding enough men for the job. It was in finding the right men from the many ready to offer themselves up for duty. Civic responsibility, a passion for justice, and simple human decency were augmented by that surest of all motivators, gold. Each member of the raiding party would receive $100 payment in advance and another $100 on return. The funds would be furnished by Colonel Davenport, who also posted a $10,000 reward for a majority of the captive girls. He was mindful that some of the captives might have perished or been sold off along the way to Pago. The reward would be divided by the surviving raiding party members on their return to Tombstone with most of the captives. The Mine Owners Association of Greater Tombstone had hastily convened to pass a resolution offering a $5,000 reward based on the same conditions, no matter what the result. And $15,000 would be split by the surviving raiders on successful completion of the mission. It was a dazzling sum, for though Tombstone was a boomtown where the lucky few struck it rich, the vast majority of cowhands and miners worked like hell to earn a $5 to $10 weekly salary. Matt and Sam headed the group. Whippaneer Remy Marcan was part of the party. The others were Hal Purdy, Ed Dane, Jeff Howell, Gitas Maggard, Dutch Snyder, Juan Garza, Pima Joe, and Vern Tooker. Hal Purdy, a Texas gunslinger, was regarded as one of the fastest guns west of the Pecos. He was 40, fleshy but handsome, with thick black hair, a Greek profile, and thick lips. Ed Dane, too, was a West Texas gunman from the Big Bend region. A few years younger than Purdy, he had wispy blonde hair and blue eyes. Gitas Maggard and Dutch Snyder were partners. They long worked both sides of the law, sometimes wearing a badge, sometimes riding the Owl Hoot Trail. Maggard was small, slight, wizened. He looked like a burnt-out cinder of a man, but could outride and outlast most other men on the trail. Dutch Snyder was a head taller and some 70 pounds heavier than his partner. He was big, bear-like, with broad sloping shoulders and a barreled torso. He was easygoing and agreeable, especially for one known to have killed over a dozen men in fair duels. Howlin' Jeff Howell, the Arkansas Razorback, was in his late 20s, of medium height and build. He'd been a deputy, army scout, shotgun messenger, and a gunman for the railroads. A rooster tail hairstyle crowned a bony fish face with dark, restless eyes. He was thin-lipped, with almost no upper lip. Juan Garza was of Mexican ancestry with some Indian blood. He'd been a lawman, scout, bounty hunter. 50-ish, he had iron gray hair and mustache, misty dark brown eyes, and a square-shaped torso. A dead shot with a rifle, he favored a sawed-off shotgun for in-close work. As his name implied, Pima Joe was a member of the Pima Indian tribe. It was said of the Pimas that they were the one neighboring tribe feared by the Apaches. In any case, Joe had given them plenty of reason to fear him, having worked as an army scout in the territory for much of the previous 2 decades. He wore a round-top-crowned black hat with an eagle feather in the hat band. Vern Tooker was another of the last of the mountain men, a hunter, trapper, Indian fighter, and scout, roaming from the northern range to the southwest. He was big and tough, his face and body well scarred. A Sharps 50 long rifle buffalo gun was sheathed in his saddle scabbard. The OK Corral served as an assembly area. Tension was in the air, the raiders eyeing each other like a pack of tomcats in a midnight alley, sizing up the competition. A fair-sized crowd had gathered to watch from the sidelines. Great effort had been expended to ensure the party got as early a start as possible. The raiders all had their own mounts, but pack horses were needed to carry supplies of water, food, and ammunition. Other horses were collected to serve as spares. Colonel Davenport was footing most of the bills, but civic-minded Tombstone merchants had opened stores and shops in the pre-dawn darkness to make up the supplies and rations needed, donating them gratis in most cases.
Some of you might wonder why we're going with so few men. This raid calls for speed and surprise. The fewer men, the faster we'll travel. We gotta be in Pago by Saturday at the latest, and a day sooner wouldn't hurt. With luck, we'll make it there in 2 days hard riding, which puts us there Thursday. There'll be lots of strangers in town and plenty of gringos, so a group this size shouldn't attract much attention. Anything larger might put the slave masters on guard and make our job that much harder. There's enough willing in town to recruit a small army, but if we did, the slavers would just hide the girls where we couldn't find them, or kill them outright to keep us from having them.
I don't like going in blind. How can you be sure of knowing where the girls are?
We got a few inns in Pago, Ed. I'll tell you more when we're out of town where there's less chance of unfriendly ears overhearing. We've got to walk soft, move fast. Surprise, speed, hitting hard. That's the key to success. This isn't a military mission, it's a raid. More like a train robbery or robbing a bank.
That ought to be right up our line, Jeetus.
Shut your mouth, Dutch.
What for? We ain't wanted for anything in Arizona.
I like it better this way. Less men, the bigger the payday.
How are we supposed to bring the girls back? There's not enough horses.
I'm glad you agree, Jeff. And Juan, it'd be a tip-off if we rode in trailing a string of extra horses for the girls. Once we're down there, we'll get them the old-fashioned way. Horse theft. We're gonna shoot up Pago and grab the girls back. I don't reckon we can make Don Carlos any madder by stealing his horses. Any more questions? No? Good. You took the gold, and you're in for the duration. I know what kind of men you are. You wouldn't have been picked if there was any worry about your taking off with the gold. Funny things can happen on the trail, though, so I give you all fair warning. If any man tries to quit before the mission is done, I'll kill him.
If I don't get to him first.
The men prepared to mount up. Sam looked to his right and saw that Stebbins had a horse saddled and was leading it to where the other horses were standing.
What are you doing, Stebbins?
I'm coming with you.
You're not serious.
Ah, but Colonel Davenport is. I'll be bringing along a sizable amount of discretionary funds, and he insists that I accompany the expedition to see that his money is well spent. He also wants an eyewitness present to make a full report on how Markhan's machine gun performs in the field.
This is no job for a desk man. The ride alone's enough to ruin anybody but a seasoned horseman. Not to mention you've got a better than even chance of getting killed.
I'll take that chance. 10 years ago, when I first came out west, clerking jobs were few and far between. One took the work where it could be found. I was the original circuit riding bookkeeper at all the big strikes.
Ever use that gun you're wearing on your hip?
Yes. Not lately, but I practice regularly to keep my hand in.
Ever kill a man with it?
2, ma'am. Robbers. Really, Mr. Two Wolf, there's no point in arguing. What you or I want in the matter is unimportant. The Colonel has his mind set on my making the trip. Take it up with him if you like, though I assure you that once he's made his mind up, he's as steadfast as a rock.
You've got sand, Stebbins. I'll give you that. Not a lot of sense, maybe, but sand.
Matt walked over to where they were standing, and Sam told him the news. Matt just shook his head.
I hope you know what you're doing, Stebbins. Every man's got to carry his weight on this go. If you change your mind or can't keep up, you'll be cut loose and left to your own devices, same as anybody else in this bunch.
I expect nothing less.
Well, welcome aboard, then, and good luck. I admire your guts, if not your good sense.
Yellow rays shafted fanwise out of the eastern horizon, heralding the sunrise.
Daylight's burning. Saddle up, men, and let's ride.
As they rode, the temperature climbed with the sun as it inched up the vault of sky. They were heading for the desert. The riders began grouping together in twos and threes, according to the degree of affinity between them. Matt and Sam rode together at the point, Hal Purdy riding up along with them. Remy Markhand and Arnold Stebbins rode side by side, Ed Dane making up a third. Markhand and Stebbins had a mutual interest in Colonel Davenport, and Dane was fascinated by the idea of the machine gun, pumping Markhand with questions about it. Dane and Purdy would have ridden with anyone as long as it wasn't with each other. Partners Geetus Maggard and Dutch Snyder were paired farther down the line. Hal and Jeff Howell and Vern Tooker strung together. Juan Garza and Pima Joe rode at the tail of the column, where horseman Garza trailed the string of pack horses and spares, keeping an eye on the animals and their burdens. Garza and Pima Joe, both men of few words, seem to take some enjoyment in each other's laconic company. To the column's right, running north to south, stretched the San Pedro River, a scrub of greenery grown along its banks, making a welcome change from tan and sandy wastes sprawling on all sides. The column angled south by southeast, away from the San Pedro, passing far-flung, isolated branches. A blur in the southern distance gradually resolved itself into the figures of a group of mounted men.
Riders up ahead. Three or four, I make it.
Four.
They ain't hiding. They're showing themselves.
It's okay, Hal. They're with us.
Sam turned in the saddle, telling those riding behind to pass the word along the column that the quartet ahead were friendlies. Presently, the column approached a crossroads. Waiting in the shade of a clump of mesquite trees were Ringo, Curly Bill, Gila Chacon, and Polk Muldoon. The road east led to the McClory brothers' ranch. Siblings Tom and Will McClory were in the inner circle of the cowboy faction, friends of Johnny Ringo and Curly Bill. Ringo, Bill, Gila, and Polk had gone to the ranch after the jailbreak. Ringo and Bill had set the crossroads as their meeting place when they'd made plans with Sam and Matt last night at Big Sky Saloon. The four rode out to meet the column.
They're going with us. Most of you know Ringo, Bill, and Polk. The bandito is from Pago, knows the ins and outs of it. He knows some folks there that'll help us out.
Well, I trust him.
Don Carlos is an enemy of Chacon's. He sent three men to kill him. That's why Chacon was caught and in jail, waiting for the hangman.
I don't like it. What's to stop him from leading us into a trap or selling us out when we reach Pago?
My gun, Hal.
That's good enough for me.
We're Chacon's best hope. Hell, only hope. For tearing into Don Carlos and breaking his power. He needs us, and we can damn sure use him.
An excellent basis for trust, senor.
How does this affect the split of the reward? That's what I want to know. Four more slices of the pie mean smaller shares for the rest of us.
Gila gets no share, Gitas. There's a rope waiting for him in Tombstone, and he can't come in to collect.
Ringo, Bill, and Polk come in for equal shares.
Don't know as I like that.
They run the same risks as the rest of us and come in for an equal payday. That's fair.
For myself, I'm glad to have these men with us. We need guns such as theirs.
I've ridden with Polk and he's plenty salty. And I reckon everybody here knows what Ringo and Curly Bill can do.
The others seem to agree with Vern Tooker.
I suppose enough of us get killed to fatten them shares back up.
That's Gitas for you, always looking on the bright side.
Gila turned toward Polk.
We go into dangerous country, amigo. My gun?
Sam and Matt exchanged glances, nodding.
Give him his gun, Polk.
Polk Muldoon raised the flap of his saddlebag and pulled out Gila's gun belt and gun, handing it to him.
Gracias.
He fastened the belt around his waist, snugging it into place, settling the soft leather holster where it hung down from his hip.
I am going to reach for my gun now, to make sure it is in working order. I tell you this so none of you bad hombres gets the wrong idea. I would hate for there to be a tragic misunderstanding before we have a chance to get to know each other better.
You sure would.
Gila reached for his gun, slowly drawing it from the holster. Holding it so it wasn't pointing at anyone, he checked the action. Satisfied, he put it back in the holster.
I could use a rifle, too. When someone shoots at you from a distance, it is good to be able to shoot back, no?
Oh, what the hell? Give him a rifle, somebody.
Juan Garza had an extra rifle on his horse, so he took it out of its scabbard and handed it over to Gila.
Winchester. Oh, this is very good, senores.
He filled his saddle scabbard with the rifle.
Now, on to Pago, eh, muchachos? Vámonos!
Eventually, they came to Candido's Cantina in Fronteras, Mexico. Fronteras was a border town, located not too far south of the dividing line between Arizona Territory and the state of Sonora, separating the United States from Mexico. Like most border towns, it was tough, rowdy, wide open, a meeting place of smugglers, rustlers, fugitives, and outlaws. Ringo and Curly Bill knew it well. Most of Tombstone's cowboy faction actually were or had been working cowboys. Cowboys who jumped the fence between law and outlawry. Cattle rustling was their meat and potatoes, the heart and soul of their larcenous enterprise. The cowboys rustled livestock on both sides of the border, stealing stock in Arizona and selling it in Mexico. Stealing stock in Mexico and selling it in Arizona. There was plenty of hijacking and robbery, too. Contraband was constantly being moved across the border. Here, information, too, was a commodity to be bought, sold, or traded. Commerce of this sort was a specialty of the house at Candido's Cantina. Of all the brokers of the latest word or news, few were better informed than the cantina's proprietor, Candy Candido himself. The Tombstone Rescue Raiders made brief camp at a secure and isolated spot outside Fronteras. They kept a low profile to avoid attracting notice of their descent into Sonora. Ringo and Curly Bill Brocious knew the campsite well. They'd used it before during some of their own rustling schemes and deals. It was an oval park hidden among low, rounded, wooded hills. A stream ran through it, and there was good grazing grass for the horses. Ringo and Matt rode into Fronteras, following an indirect route little traveled, one known to Ringo. They threaded narrow, dusty dirt streets through blocks of one-room, flat-roofed adobe houses, honeycombed by corrals, huts, backyard gardens. Candido's Cantina was one such whitewashed rectangular cube. It had small, square windows. Its open front door was an oblong of murky blackness. It was aromatic with the scent of baked corn tortillas and coffee. A line of horses was hitched in front of the cantina. Matt and Ringo rode around to the back. They stepped down from the saddle, hitching their mounts to the top rail of a skeletal wooden pole fence.
The horse is okay here?
Anybody dumb enough to steal a horse from Candy's would be found in an alley with his throat cut, and everyone knows it.
That'd be scant consolation if it left me without a horse.
Yeah, they'll be okay.
A massive, wide-bodied woman sat on a three-legged stool in the shade of a wooden awning overhanging the back door. She weighed about as much as Matt and Ringo put together. A golden moon face showed heavy-lidded black button eyes, a wide flat nose, and a tiny puckered cherub mouth. Thick black hair tied up in a bun was held in place by a knotted strip of rainbow-colored cloth. She was adorned with oversized silver and turquoise earrings and a necklace made of the same materials. She puffed on a corncob pipe. Whatever she was smoking, it didn't smell like tobacco.
Hola. I'm Ringo.
She looked up, eyeing him.
I know who you are.
Tell Candy I want to see him.
Tell him yourself.
She indicated the back door. Matt and Ringo exchanged glances, Matt shrugging.
Gracias.
They walked in. Candy Candido was drinking tequila by himself in the back room. The room was warm and dim, filled with dark brown shadows like pools of warm, muddy water. Candido was short and stout of indeterminate origins and nationality. He had a wide, thick black mustache, jug ears, and a lot of chin and jaw. He wore a baggy white Mexican long-sleeve shirt, a thin reddish-brown leather vest that barely reached down below his armpits, white pantaloons and sandals.
Yeah. Who's your friend, Ringo?
Matt Bodine.
So... You're Bodine, eh? I've heard of you. Where's your Indian part?
He's around.
Candido set out two glazed brown ceramic cups on the table, duplicates of the one from which he was drinking. He filled all three and they drank up, Matt repressing a shudder. It was strong stuff. Matt's face reddened. He broke a fresh sweat, shivering at the same time. Candido refilled the cups. Matt drank his more slowly, taking small sips.
I like good talk, but I don't have time to sit around and chew the fat.
In a hurry to kill someone, huh?
Does it show that badly?
There's a kind of look you get when you're on the prod. Your face and neck swell up like a puff adder about to strike. Who's the lucky fellow?
Angus Jones.
Black Angus. What have you got against him, Ringo?
Two of his men killed a friend of mine. Bob Farr. Shot him in the back.
Why don't you kill them, then?
I will.
I don't believe in doing things by halves. Seen Jones lately?
No, but I know he's been around recent-like.
When?
Yesterday. I didn't see Jones himself, mind you. Two of his men, Donegan and Porgy Best. They came in here about sundown.
What did they want?
They was looking to see which of the boys was around, searching for likely prospects, you see. Zach Severly, Nolan Hall, and Ian Pate rode out with them.
Where'd they go?
Black Angus is a slave hunter, a woman stealer. Everybody knows that. They going to the auction in Pago. He figures he took on Sachs and them as extra guns. Gringo guns.
Much traffic headed that way, Candy?
Buyers? None. Sellers? Some. Slavers bypass this town if they can. Too many bad boys here looking for trouble. They'd steal the women from the woman stealers if they could.
What else do you hear?
No buyers come through here, Ringo. The white slave traffic runs north to south, not the other way. The auction in Pago is a big thing. The town's big man, Don Carlos, puts on the dog for his guests, like a fiesta.
Except for the girls who get sold.
Well, yes, there's that.
Anything else I should know?
Don Carlos is sitting on a powder keg, from what I hear. He's greedy. Well, ain't we all? But Don Carlos is overdoing it. His men harrow town and countryside for fresh young girls to sell to beef up his quota. A lot of bad feelings there. Not a townsman or peon who hasn't lost a female to the slavers. Don Carlos is safe as long as he's got Captain Bravo siding him. Bravo heads the Pago Presidio, an army fort that's supposed to guard the road south into the interior from Apaches, Yaquis, and bandits. Don Carlos cuts him in on the slave trade profits, which are considerable.
That's it, Candy.
That's all of it.
Ringo and Matt rose from their chairs.
We'll be moseying then.
Ringo set a couple of gold coins down on the table. Candido rested a meaty hand on them. When he lifted it, the coins were gone, disappeared into his fisted palm.
Gracias.
Oh, one more thing, Candy. I'd take it poorly if you were to spread word that friend Bodine and I have been asking around about Jones.
Information is my stock in trade, Ringo.
Killing is mine. Keep your mouth shut, Candy. Word to the wise.
Sure, Ringo, sure. You can count on me. You know that.
What a thought.
Why won't you let me be?
Paco Maldonado sat in the corner of the Red Mill Cantina in Front Terrace at dusk, trying to sleep off this afternoon's drunk. His arms were folded on the table, pillowing the head which lay on its side atop them. A broad sombrero covered his head to keep out the light, such as it was, the light of a dying day. Someone was tugging at Paco's sleeve at the elbow, a persistent bastard who wouldn't leave him alone. He'd slept for a few fitful hours, drifting in and out of wakefulness, trying to stay submerged in sodden slumber.
Go away, pest!
Paco's head rose. His gummy eyes flickered open. He was in his early 20s, raw-boned, thin-faced, with high cheekbones and thick, matte black hair reaching to his jawline. He wore a holstered gun and bandoliers across his chest, and a machete dangled by a rawhide loop from his belt. A repeating rifle stood near at hand. Bleary, red-eyed, he peered at his tormentor as if through a smoke-fogged room. His nemesis was a young boy, a street urchin, solemn as an owl.
What do you want, insect?
The señorita.
What? What's that? What, señorita?
The lady. Her.
The boy pointed to the entrance. A fine-looking young woman stood outside the entryway, looking in. She had shiny, long black hair, bold dark eyes, a sweetly wicked face, and shapely figure that was being shown off to best advantage by a low-cut white blouse and tight skirt. She beckoned, motioning Paco to her. Paco stood up, still clumsy with the alcohol in him. He pulled his hat down tightly on his head to keep it from falling off. The boy stood in front of him, blocking the way, hand held out, palm up.
The lady say you will pay me a coin for running the errand.
Paco stared down at him foggily, swaying slightly. He dug a hand into his vest side pocket, fumbling out a few small copper coins. He dropped one in the boy's palm. The boy darted away through the crowd and disappeared. Paco glanced at the doorway. It was empty. The girl, gone. He picked up his rifle and went to the door. He stepped outside. Dusky purple shadows pooled at the edges of things. Above low rooftops, the sky was dark blue with a handful of twinkling stars. Paco looked around for the girl. She stood on the other side of the small square formed by the intersection of two side streets. Her back was to him. She looked over her shoulder at him, flashing him a come-hither look, a smooth curve of golden flesh bared by the scooped-out neck of the blouse. Inky black hair glided water-like across her upper back and shoulders. She stood there, waiting. He crossed to the woman.
What do you want, Chiquita?
From you, nothing.
She pointed down a side street.
He wants to talk to you.
A lone man sat a horse a half dozen paces away beside the wall of a house whose overhanging eaves shadowed his upper body.
Who is he?
The girl shrugged. Paco's once bleary eyes were in focus now. He looked at the stranger. He wore a broad-brimmed sombrero, the brim decorated with rebozos, little black pom-poms hanging on short strings along the rim of the hat. Generally, it was a somewhat ridiculous affectation on a man's headgear, clownish, but not on this hombre. He looked like a serious individual. The comical touch was more sinister than laughable. A patterned blue and white serape, long, narrow blanket was draped around his shoulders and upper body. The band of dangling rebozos partly veiled his eyes, and the serape folds hid his lower face. A gun in a buscadero rig was holstered on his hip, and a repeating rifle was stowed in his saddle scabbard. Masked? Well, many men of Paco's acquaintance had cause to hide their faces. He'd done it himself many a time, but usually only when pulling a job of crime.
What do you want, hombre? Do I know you? Show your face.
A lamp was lit in a second-story room above the side street, light shining down on the stranger. Moving easily, carefully, he lifted a hand to lower the serape folds, uncovering his face.
Gila Chacon!
Gila tilted down the hat so that its broad brim once more threw his face into shadow, agitating the little black pom-pom rebozos so they swung back and forth. Paco went to him.
Do I see truly? Is it really you?
Where do you think I was, Paco? In a gringo jail?
Jefe, chief, I swear. Me and some of the other muchachos were going to ride north and break you out of jail.
Like the gringos say, I'd hate to have to hang by the neck waiting for the likes of you to come to the rescue.
We had an escape plan, Jefe. I swear on my mother.
Don't take your mother's name in vain. Poor woman already has too many gray hairs on her head from birthing a bad boy like you, Paco. As you can see, I freed myself. Gila Chacon waits on no man, nor needs to.
But this is wonderful!
Si, it's wonderful, si. What of the rest of the gang? My guardsmen, where are they?
Octavio, Felipe, and Bronco Duro are all in Fronteras with me. We're here to make a raid across the border into Tombstone, like I said.
Never mind all about that now. And the rest of the muchachos?
Most of them are in town. If you are at the hideout in Pago,
hoping to rob some of the buyers of their girls or their gold.
Not many, though, since it's the rope or the firing squad if they're caught down there.
So much the better. Round up the three guardsmen and have them round up the muchachos.
You got something planned for that pig of a Don Carlos, eh, Jefe?
Something big, Paco. Maybe the biggest job ever. One that will bury our enemies and make us a power in the land. The time is right to deal a death blow to our foes, Don Carlos, Sebastiano, Capitan Bravo, Sancho, Dorado, and Carmen. We, you, me, all of us, must act fast to ensure that this golden opportunity for revenge does not slip through our fingers. Only you know that I am alive. Tell the rest of the guardsmen, but no others. You four have been running the gang in my absence. Muchachos will do what you say when you tell them to ride to Pago. Gather up the most dependable of our men, the tried and true pistoleros and stone killers.
Don't bother with the hangers-on and camp followers. Don't bother with anybody that hasn't ridden with us before. Only those with a price on their heads. Stay out of town and meet me tomorrow. Oh, one more thing. Pepe Herrera, he is still in Pago?
Sí, jefe. Alive and uncaught when last I heard. Don Carlos thinks he's loyal.
Good. Let's keep him thinking that way. Don't try to contact him, Paco. I will get in touch with him myself. Comprende?
Sí, jefe, sí.
Tomorrow, then.
Sam Two Wolves and Remy Marcand came to the town of Pago. Pago was important culturally and commercially, having been founded 300 years earlier. The first building to arise on the site was the Presidio, a military fort of massive cyclopean stone block construction built by Indian slaves and convict labor battalions. The Presidio squatted on a rocky knob apart from the rest of the town, brooding over the flat plains trending northward to the mountains of the Espinazo. Stretching across the flat was the Camino Real, a king's highway connecting far-distant Mexico City in the southern interior to the great southwestern desert of the north. Pago means payment, and the town was well named, for from earliest times, royal officials and military commanders had collected tolls and taxes on all travelers passing by this way on the Camino Real. The body of the town was set on a wide, low, flat-topped rise. Its central feature was the Zócalo, the plaza, around whose square sides the main buildings had been raised, the heart of the old colonial administrative apparatus. On the west side of the plaza, fronting east, stood the cathedral, an ornate structure of ash-gray stone with lofty, needle-like spires, flying buttresses, octagonal side chapels, pointed arches, steep slanted roofs, and elaborate decorative stone carvings. North stood the Palacio, the Royal Colonial Administration's headquarters, and now the seat of the district's government. It was a three-story office building housing a tribunal court, extensive historical archives, and the numerous small offices of an arrogant and overbearing bureaucracy. The plaza's east side held a row of commercial buildings, including an indoor mercado, a marketplace, and a selection of government-licensed shops and stores selling various high-line, expensive goods. A wide, flat, square plaza, open on the south side, featured lines of temporary booths and stalls selling a variety of goods and foodstuffs. The Zócalo and environs comprised the old town. In the center of the plaza lay a broken fountain with a dry basin. At the basin's midpoint stood a pedestal atop which, facing north, sat a monumental cast bronze statue of an armor-clad conquistador on a horse. The conquistador held a lance. The horse reared up on its two hind legs. Time had weathered the bronze to a pale green hue, and nature had layered it with white pigeon guano. At 8 in the morning, Sam and Marcand met their local contact, Pepe Herrera, at the fountain. Herrera, a feisty bantamweight, seemed natty and dapper, though his clothes were frayed and threadbare, and his boots wearing down on the uppers. He was medium-sized, thin, nimble, with sharp-pointed features and a hooked nose, wide, expressive mouth, graying mustache, and chin whiskers. Deep-set eyes burned in a hollow-cheeked face. He was one of a staff of temporary workers employed twice yearly at the Opera House, before, during, and after auction week. A Pago town dweller, he was maintenance man and handyman, a jack-of-all-trades. He would arrange for Sam and Remy Marcand to take a tour of the Opera House this morning. Pepe Herrera was one of Gila Chacon's contacts. Chacon had brought them together because the Tombstone Rescue Raiders couldn't do their job blindfolded. They needed inside information, the layout of the Opera House, location of the captives, and disposition of enemy forces. An underground resistance against Don Carlos and his slave hunters had long been building in Pago. The would-be rebels had penetrated the operation, planting their people inside. But so far, they'd been unable to strike back effectively.
Between Don Carlos and Capitan Bravo, they have us outgunned.
We've come to even up those odds.
Marcand would pretend to be a slave buyer, while Sam would pose as his bodyguard. Sam and Remy were dressed accordingly. They were able to get the garments from some of Gila's group. The jacket was tight around Sam's shoulders and the pants baggy at the hips, but the garments were new and expensive enough to enhance the masquerade. Remy donned a white ruffled shirt with a black satin cravat and pearl stick pin. They kept their weapons, holstered belt guns. In addition, Remy had a sleeve gun hidden inside his right cuff and a derringer in his left jacket pocket. Sam had a long knife worn sheathed under his left arm and a second short, thin throwing knife, little more than a sharp-pointed, keen-edged piece of stamped-out metal worn on a rawhide thong hanging down between his shoulder blades. Sam, Remy, and Pepe Herrera stood at the west of the fountain and basin, in the shadow of the conquistador's bronze statue. A number of idlers loitered in the plaza, most clad in elegant, expensive garments, well-to-do gentlemen and their ladies.
Nice day.
You see that there are a few townsfolk abroad enjoying this fine weather. Families lock up their daughters and stay closely by their sides when the auction comes around, afraid they'll be stolen and sold to Don Carlos to round off some consignment of flesh. But enough of an old man's bitterness. You come well recommended if Gila Chacon vouches for you. Now to business. You have gold with you.
Some, enough for now. How much do you need?
No, the gold is not for me, but for them, the slave masters. No one needs a special invitation to attend the auction. No, the ticket of admission is a pocket full of gold. Hard cash is the only bona fides required.
I got enough to make a fair showing with more available for the auction if needed.
Good. Shall we go?